Athaclena suddenly knew this beast was not a natural find. It was not the fabled Garthling her father had asked her to seek. The family resemblance was simply too unmistakable. She was looking at a gathering of cousins, sitting together on that branch high above the Gubru vapors. Human, neo-chimpanzees, and... what? She tried to recall what her father had said about humanity's license to occupy their home world, the Earth. After contact, the institutes had granted recognition of mankind's de facto tenancy. Still, there were fallow rules and other restrictions, she was certain, and a few special Earth species had been mentioned in particular. The great beast radiated potential like... A metaphor came to Athaclena of a beacon burning in the tree across from her. Searching her memory, Timbrimi fashion, she at last drew forth the name she had been looking for.
"Pretty thing," she asked softly. "You are a gorilla, aren't you?"
Chapter 16 A Howlett's Center. The beast tossed its great head and snorted. Next to it, the mother chimp whimpered softly and regarded Athaclena with obvious dread. But the little human girl clapped her hands, sensing a game.
"Rilla! Johnny's a Rilla, like me!"
The child's small fists thumped her chest. She threw back her head and crowed a high-pitched, ululating yell.
Gorilla!
Athaclena looked at the giant, silent creature in wonderment, trying to remember what she had been told in passing so long ago. Its dark nostrils flared as it sniffed in Athaclena's direction and used its free hand to make quick, subtle hand signs to the human child.
"Johnny wants to know if you're going to be in charge now,"
the little girl lisped.
"I hope so. You sure looked tired when you stopped chasing Benjamin. Did he do something bad? He got away, you know."
Athaclena moved a little closer.
"No," she said. "Benjamin didn't do anything bad. At least, not since I met him, though I am beginning to suspect."
Athaclena stopped. Neither the child nor the gorilla would understand what she now suspected, but the adult chim knew clearly, and her eyes showed fear.
"I'm April,"
the small human told her.
"And that's Nita. Her baby's name is Cha-Cha. Sometimes chimmies give their babies easy names to start, 'cause they don't talk so good at first," she confided.
Her eyes seemed to shine as she looked at Athaclena.
"Are you really a Timbimi?
Athaclena nodded.
"I am Timbrimi."
April clapped her hands.
"Ooh, they're good guys. Did you see the big spaceship? It came with a big boom, and Daddy made me go with Johnny, and then there was gas, and Johnny put his hand over my mouth, and I couldn't breathe."
April made a scrunched-up face, pantomiming suffocation.
"He let go when we were up in the trees, though. We found Nita and Cha-Cha."
She glanced over at the chims.
"I guess Nita's still too scared to talk much."
"Were you frightened, too?"
Athaclena asked. April nodded seriously.
"Yes, but I had to stop being scared. I was the only man here, and I had to be in charge and take care of everybody."
"Can you be in charge now? You're really pretty, Timbimi."
The little girl's shyness returned. She partly buried herself against Johnny's massive chest, smiling out at Athaclena with only one eye showing. Athaclena could not help staring. She had never until now realized this about human beings, of what they were capable. In spite of her people's alliance with the Terrans, she had picked up some of the common galactic prejudice, imagining that the wolflings were still somehow feral, bestial. Many galactics thought it questionable that humans were truly ready to be patrons. No doubt the Gubru had expressed that belief in their war manifesto. This child shattered that image altogether. By law and custom, little April had been in charge of her clients, no matter how young she was, and her understanding of that responsibility was clear. Still, Athaklana now knew why both Robert and Benjamin had been anxious not to lead her here. She suppressed her initial surge of righteous anger. Later, she would have to find a way to get word to her father after she had verified her suspicions. She was almost beginning to feel Tim Brimmy again as the gear reaction gave way to a mere dull burning along her muscles and neural pathways.
"Did any other humans make it into the trees?" she asked.
Johnny made a quick series of hand signs. April interpreted, although the little girl may not have clearly understood the implications.
"He says a few tried, but they weren't fast enough. Most of them just ran around doing man things. That's what Rillas call the stuff humans do that Rillas don't understand," she confided lowly.
At last, the mother chim, Nita, spoke.
"The gas,"
she swallowed.
"The gas made the humans weak."
Her voice was barely audible.
"Some of us chims felt it a little. I don't think the Rillas were bothered."
So, perhaps Athaklana's original surmise about the gas was correct. She had suspected it was not intended to be immediately lethal. Mass slaughter of civilians was something generally frowned upon by the Institute for Civilized Warfare. Knowing the Gubru, the intent was probably much more insidious than that. There was a cracking sound to her right. The large male chim, Benjamin, dropped onto a branch 2 trees away. He called out to Athaklana.
"It's okay now, miss. I found Dr. Taka and Dr. Schultz. They're anxious to talk to you."
Athaklana motioned for him to approach.
"Please, come here first, Benjamin."
With typical Pongo exaggeration, Benjamin let out a long, suffering sigh. He leaped branch to branch until he came into view of the 3 apes and the human girl. Then his jaw dropped, and his balancing grip almost slipped. Frustration rode across his face. He turned to Athaklana, licking his lips, and cleared his throat.
"Don't bother," she told him. "I know you have spent the last 20 minutes trying, in the midst of all this turmoil, to arrange to have the truth hidden. But it was to no avail. I know what has been going on here."
Benjamin's mouth clapped shut. Then he shrugged.
"So?"
he sighed. To the 4 on the branch, Athaklana asked,
"Do you accept my authority?"
"Yeah,"
April said. Nita glanced from Athaklana to the human child, then nodded.
"All right, then. Stay where you are until somebody comes for you. You understand?"
"Yes'm."
Nita nodded again. Johnny and Cha-Cha merely looked back at her. Athaklana stood up, finding her balance on the branch, and turned to Benjamin.
"Now let us talk to these uplift specialists of yours. If the gas has not completely incapacitated them, I'll be interested to hear why they have chosen to violate galactic law."
Benjamin looked defeated. He nodded resignedly.
"Also,"
Athaklana told him as she landed on the branch next to him,
"you had better catch up with the chims and gorillas you sent away, in order that I would not see them. They should be called back. We may need their help."
Chapter 17 Pippin. Pippin had managed to fashion a crutch out of shattered tree limbs lying near the furrow torn up by his escape pod. Cushioned by tatters of his ship suit, the crutch jarred his shoulder only partially out of joint each time he leaned on it.
"Hmph," he thought. "If the humans hadn't straightened our spines and shortened our arms, I could have knuckle-walked back to civilization."
Dazed, bruised, hungry, actually, Pippin was in a pretty good mood as he picked his way through obstacles on his way northward.
"Hell, I'm alive. I can't really complain."
He had spent quite a lot of time in the mountains of Mulan, doing ecological studies for the restoration project, so he could tell that he had to be in the right watershed, not too far from known lands. The varieties of vegetation were all quite recognizable, mostly native plants, but also some that had been imported and released into the ecosystem to fill gaps left by the Burrali Holocaust. Pippin felt optimistic. To have survived this far, even up to crash landing in familiar territory, it made him certain that Ifni had further plans for him. She had to be saving him for something special. Probably a fate that would be particularly annoying and much more painful than mere starvation in the wilderness. Pippin's ears perked and he looked up. Could he have imagined that sound? No, those were voices. He stumbled down the game path, alternately skipping and pole vaulting on his makeshift crutch, until he came to a sloped clearing overlooking a steep canyon. Minutes passed as he peered. The rainforest was so damn dense. There. On the other side, about halfway down slope, six chims wearing backpacks could be seen moving rapidly through the forest, heading toward some of the still smoldering wreckage of TAASF Proconsul. Right now they were quiet. It was just a lucky break they had spoken as they passed below his position.
"Hey! Dummies, over here!"
He hopped on his right foot and waved his arms, shouting. The search party stopped. The chims looked about, blinking, as the echoes bounced around the narrow defile. Pippin's teeth bared, and he couldn't help growling low in frustration. They were looking everywhere, but in his direction. Finally, he picked up the crutch, whirled it above his head, and threw it out over the canyon. One of the chims exclaimed, grabbing another. They watched the tumbling branch crash into the forest.
"That's right," Pippin urged. "Now think. Retrace the arc backwards."
Two of the searchers pointed up his way and saw him waving. They shrieked in excitement, capering in circles. Forgetting momentarily his own little regression, Pippin muttered under his breath,
"Just my luck to be rescued by a bunch of grunts. Come on, guys, let's not make a thunder dance out of it."
Still, he grinned when they neared his hillside clearing, and in all the subsequent hugging and backslapping, he forgot himself and let out a few glad hoots of his own. Chapter 18 Utha Calling. His little pinnace was the last craft to take off from the Port Helena spacefield. Already detection screens showed battle cruisers descending into the lower atmosphere. Back at the port, a small force of militiamen and Terrigan's marines prepared to make a futile last stand. Their defiance was broadcast on all channels. "We deny the invaders' rights to land here. We claim the protection of galactic civilization against their aggression. We refuse the Gubru permission to set down on our legal leasehold. In earnest of this, a small, armed, formal resistance detachment awaits the invaders at the capital spaceport. Our challenge..." Utha Calving guided his pinnace with nonchalant nudges on the wrist and thumb controllers. The tiny ship raced southward along the coast of the Sea of Silmar, faster than sound. Bright sunshine reflected off the broad waters to his right. Should they dare to face us being to being, not cowering in their battleships? Utha Calving nodded.
Tell them, Earthlings, he said softly in Anglic.
The detachment commander had sought his advice in phrasing the ritual challenge. He hoped he had been of help. The broadcast went on to list the numbers and types of weapons awaiting the descending armada at the spaceport, so the enemy would have no justification for using overpowering force. Under circumstances such as these, the Gubru would have no choice but to assail the defenders with ground troops, and they would have to take casualties.
If the codes still hold, Utha Calving reminded himself, the enemy may not care about the rules of war any longer.
It was hard to imagine such a situation, but there had been rumors from across the far star lanes. A row of display screens rimmed his cockpit. One showed cruisers coming into view of Port Helena's public news cameras. Others showed fast fighters tearing up the sky right over the spaceport. Behind him, Utha Calving heard a low keening as two stilt-like yinin commiserated with each other. Those creatures, at least, had been able to fit into Timbrimi-type seats, but their hulking master had to stand. Kalt did not just stand, he paced the narrow cabin, his crest inflating until it bumped the low ceiling again and again. The Thenanin was not in a good mood.
"Why, Utha Calving?" he muttered for what was not the first time. "Why did you delay for so long? We were the very last to get out of there."
Kalt's breathing vents puffed.
"You told me we would leave night before last. I hurried to gather a few possessions and be ready, and you did not come. I waited. I missed opportunities to hire other transport while you sent message after message urging patience. And then, when you came at last after dawn, we departed as blithely as if we were on a holiday ride to the Progenitor's Arch."
Utha Calving let his colleague grumble on. He had already made formal apologies and paid diplomatic guild in compensation. No more was required of him. Besides, things were going just the way he had planned them to. A yellow light flashed on the control board, and a tone began to hum.
"What is that?" Kalt shuffled forward in agitation. "Have they detected our engines?"
"No."
And Kalt sighed in relief. Utha Calving went on.
"It isn't the engines. That light means we've just been scanned by a probability beam."
"What?"
Kalt nearly screamed.
"Isn't this vessel shielded? You aren't even using gravitics. What anomalous probability could they have picked up?"
Utha Calving shrugged, as if the human gesture had been born to him.
"Perhaps the unlikelihood is intrinsic," he suggested. "Perhaps it is something about us, about our own fate, that is glowing along the world lines. That may be what they detect."
Out of his right eye he saw Kalt shiver. The Thenanin race seemed to have an almost superstitious dread of anything having to do with the art, science, of reality shaping. Utha Calving allowed Luthtru apology to one's enemy, to form gently within his tendrils, and reminded himself that his people and cults were officially at war. It was within his rights to tease his enemy and friend, as it had been ethically acceptable earlier, when he had arranged for cults' own ship to be sabotaged.
"I shouldn't worry about it," he suggested. "We've got a good head start."
Before the Thenanin could reply, Utha Calving bent forward and spoke rapidly in Gal 7,
causing one of the screens to expand its image.
"Thwilkuchilio," he cursed. "Look at what they are doing."
Kalt turned and stared. The hollow display showed giant cruisers hovering over the capital city, pouring brown vapor over the buildings and parks. Though the volume was turned down, they could hear panic in the voice of the news announcer as he described the darkening skies, as if anyone in Port Helena needed his interpretation.
"This is not well."
Kalt's crest bumped the ceiling more rapidly.
"The Gubru are being more severe than the situation or their war rights here merit."
Uther Kalving nodded. But before he could speak, another yellow light winked on.
"What is it now?" Kalt sighed.
Uther Kalving's eyes were at their widest separation.
"It means we are being chased by pursuit craft," he replied. "We may be in for a fight. Can you work a Class 57 weapons console, Kalt?"
"No, but I believe one of my Yinin..."
His reply was interrupted as Uther Kalving shouted,
"Hold on!"
and turned on the pinnace's gravitics. The ground screamed past under them.
"I am beginning evasive maneuvers," he called out.
"Good,"
Kalt whispered through his neck vents.
"Oh, bless the Thenanin thick skull," Uther Kalving thought.
He kept control over his facial expression, though he knew his colleague had the empathy sensitivity of a stone and could not pick up his joy. As the pursuing ship started firing on them, his corona began to sing. Chapter 19 Athoclena. Green fingers of forest merged with the lawns and leafy-colored buildings of the center, as if the establishment were intended to be inconspicuous from the air. Although a wind from the west had finally driven away the last visible shreds of the invader's aerosol, a thin film of gritty powder covered everything below a height of 5 meters, giving off a tangy, unpleasant odor. Athoclena's corona no longer shrank under an overriding roar of panic. The mood had changed amid the buildings. There was a threat of resignation now, and intelligent anger. She followed Benjamin toward the first clearing, where she caught sight of small groups of neo-chimps running pigeon-toed within the inner compound. One pair hurried by carrying a muffled burden on a stretcher.
"Maybe you shouldn't go down there after all, miss,"
Benjamin rasped.
"I mean, it's obvious the gas was designed to affect humans, but even us chims feel a bit woozy from it. You're pretty important."
"I am Tim Brimmy," Athoclena answered coolly. "I cannot sit here while I am needed by clients and by my peers."
Benjamin bowed in acquiescence. He led her down a stair-like series of branches until she set foot with some relief on the ground. The pungent odor was thicker here. Athoclena tried to ignore it, but her pulse pounded from nervousness. They passed what had to have been facilities for housing and training gorillas. There were fenced enclosures, playgrounds, testing areas. Clearly, an intense, if small-scale, effort had gone on here. Had Benjamin really imagined that he could fool her simply by sending the pre-sentient apes into the jungle to hide? She hoped none of them had been hurt by the gas, or in the panicky aftermath. She remembered from her brief history of Earthmen class that gorillas, although strong, were also notoriously sensitive, even fragile creatures. Chims dressed in shorts, sandals, and the ubiquitous tulle bandoliers hurried to and fro on serious errands. A few stared at Athoclena as she approached, but they did not stop to speak. In fact, she heard very few words at all. Stepping lightly through the dark dust, they arrived at the center of the encampment. There, at last, she and her guide encountered humans. They lay on couches on the steps of the main building, a male and a femme. The male human's head was entirely hairless, and his eyes bore traces of epicanthic folding. He looked barely conscious. The other man was a tall, dark-haired female. Her skin was very black, a deep, rich shade Athaclena had never encountered before. Probably she was one of those rare, pure-breed humans who retained the characteristics of their ancient races. In contrast, the skin color of the chim standing next to her was almost pale pink under their patchy covering of brown hair. With the help of two older-looking chims, the black woman managed to prop herself up on one elbow as Athaclena approached. Benjamin stepped forward to make the introductions.
Dr. Taka, Dr. Schultz, Dr. Mwazeli, Chim Frederick, all of the Terran Wolfling clan, I present you to the respected Athaclena, a Timbrimi, Ab Kultmore, Ab Brimma, Ab Kralneth, Old Titlel.
Athaclena glanced at Benjamin, surprised he was able to recite her species honorific from memory.
Dr. Schultz,
Athaclena said, nodding to the chim on the left. To the woman she bowed slightly lower.
Dr. Taka.
With one last head incline, she took in the other human and chim.
Dr. Mbuzweli and Chim Frederick, please accept my condolences over the cruelty visited on your settlement and your world.
The chims bowed low. The woman tried to as well, but she failed in her weakness.
Thank you for your sentiments, she replied laboriously. We Earthlings will muddle through, I'm sure. I do admit I'm a little surprised to see the daughter of the Timbrimi ambassador pop up out of nowhere right now. I'll just bet you are,
Athaclena thought in Anglic, enjoying this once the flavor of human-style sarcasm.
My presence is nearly as much a disaster to your plans as the Gubru and their gas. I have an injured friend, she said aloud. Three of your neo-chimpanzees went after him some time ago. Have you heard anything from them?
The woman nodded.
Yes, yes, we just had a pulse from the search party. Robert Oneagle is conscious and stable. Another group we had sent to seek out a downed flyer will be joining them shortly, with full medical equipment.
Athaclena felt a tense worry unwrap in the corner of her mind where she had put it.
Good. Very good. Then I will turn to other matters.
Her corona blossomed out as she formed Kuwasu, a glyph of presentiment. Though she knew these folk would barely catch its fringes, if at all.
First, as a member of a race that has been in alliance with yours ever since you wolflings burst so loudly upon the five galaxies, I offer my assistance during this emergency. What I can do as a fellow patron, I shall do, requiring in return only whatever help you can give me in getting in touch with my father.
Done, Dr. Taka nodded. Done, and with our thanks. Athaclena took a step forward.
Second, I must exclaim my dismay on discovering the function of this center. I find you are engaged in unsanctioned uplift activities on a fallow species.
The four directors looked at each other. By now, Athaclena could read human expressions well enough to know their chagrin resignation.
Furthermore, she went on, I note that you had the poor taste to commit this crime on the planet Garth, a tragic victim of past ecological abuse.
Now, just a minute, Chim Frederick protested.
How can you compare what we're doing with the Holocaust of the Fred, be quiet,
Dr. Schultz, the other Chim, cut in urgently. Frederick blinked. Realizing it was too late to take back the interruption, he muttered on.
The only planets Earth Clan's been allowed to settle have been other E.T.'s messes.
The second human, Dr. Mbazweli, started coughing. Frederick shut up and turned away. The human male looked up at Athaclina.
You have us against the wall, miss, he sighed. Can we ask you to let us explain before you press charges? We're not representatives of our government, you understand. We are private criminals.
Athaclina felt a funny sort of relief. Old pre-contact Earthling flat movies, especially those cops and robbers thrillers so popular among the Timbrimi, often seemed to revolve around some ancient lawbreaker attempting to silence the witness. A part of her had wondered just how atavistic these people actually were. She exhaled deeply and nodded.
Very well, then. The question can be put aside during the present emergency. Please tell me the situation here. What is the enemy trying to accomplish with this gas?
It weakens any human who breathes it, Dr. Taka answered.
It was a broadcast an hour ago. The invader announced that affected humans must receive the antidote within 1 week, or die. Of course, they are offering the antidote only in urban areas. Hostage gas,
Athaclina whispered.
They want all the planet's humans as pawns. Exactly. We must ingather or drop dead in 6 days.
Athaclena's corona sparked anger. Hostage gas was an irresponsible weapon, even if it was legal under certain limited types of war.
What will happen to your clients?
Neo-chimps were only a few centuries old and should not be left unwatched in the wilderness. Dr. Taka grimaced, obviously worried as well.
Most chimps seem unaffected by the gas, but they have so few natural leaders, such as Benjamin or Dr. Schultz here.
Schultz's brown simian eyes looked down at his human friend.
Not to worry, Susan. We will, as you say, muddle through.
He turned back to Athaclina.
We're evacuating the humans in stages, starting with the children and old folks tonight. Meanwhile, we'll start destroying this compound and all traces of what's happened here.
Seeing that Athaclina was about to object, the elderly Neo-chimp raised his hand.
Yes, miss, we will provide you with cameras and assistance, so you may collect your evidence first. Will that do? We would not dream of thwarting you in your duty.
Athaclina sensed the chim geneticist's bitterness. But she had no sympathy for him, imagining how her father would feel when he learned of this. Uther Kalving liked Earthlings. This irresponsible criminality would wound him deeply.
No sense in handing the Gubru a justification for their aggression,
Dr. Taka added.
The matter of the guerrillas can go to the Timbrimi Grand Council if you wish. Our allies may then decide where to go from there, whether to press formal charges or leave our punishment to our own government.
Athaclina saw the logic in it. After a moment, she nodded.
That will do, then. Bring me your cameras, and I shall record this burning.
Chapter 20 Galactics. To the fleet admiral, the suzerain of Beam and Talon, the argument sounded silly. But of course, that was always the way of it among civilians. Priests and bureaucrats always argued. It was the fighters who believed in action. Still, the admiral had to admit that it was thrilling to take part in their first real policy debate as a threesome. This was the way truth was traditionally attained among the Gubru, through stress and disagreement, persuasion and dance, until finally a new consensus was reached. And eventually, the suzerain of Beam and Talon shook aside the thought. It was much too soon to begin contemplating the molt. There would be many more arguments, much jostling and maneuvering for the highest perch before that day arrived. As for this first debate, the Admiral was pleased to find itself in the position of arbiter between its two bickering peers. This was a good way to begin. The Terrans at the small spaceport had issued a well-written formal challenge. The suzerain of propriety insisted that Talon soldiers must be sent to overcome the defenders in close combat. The suzerain of cost and caution did not agree. For some time they circled each other on the dais of the flagship's bridge, eyeing each other and squawking pronouncements of argument.
"Expenses must be kept low, low enough that we need not burden other fronts."
The suzerain of cost and caution thus insisted that this expedition was only one of many engagements currently sapping the strength of the clan of Guxiu Gubru. In fact, it was rather a side battle. Matters were tense across the galactic spiral. In such times it was the job of the suzerain of cost and caution to protect the clan from overextending itself. The suzerain of propriety huffed its feathers indignantly in response.
"What shall expense matter, mean, signify, stand for, if we fall, topple, drop, plummet from grace, in the eyes of our ancestrals? We must do what is right. Zoon!"
Observing from its own perch of command, the suzerain of Beam and Talon watched the struggle, to see if any clear patterns of dominance were about to manifest themselves. It was thrilling to hear and see the excellent argument dances performed by those who had been chosen to be the Admiral's mates. All three of them represented the finest products of hot egg engineering, designed to bring out the best qualities of the race. Soon, it was obvious that its peers had reached a stalemate. It would be up to suzerain of Beam and Talon to decide. It certainly would be less costly if the expeditionary force could simply ignore the insolent wolflings below until the hostage gas forced them to surrender. Or, with a simple order, their redoubt could be reduced to slag. But the suzerain of propriety refused to accept either option. Such actions would be catastrophic, the priest insisted. The bureaucrat was just as adamant not to waste good soldiers on what would be essentially a gesture. Deadlocked, the two other commanders eyed the suzerain of Beam and Talon as they circled and squawked, fluffing their glowing white down. Finally, the admiral ruffled its own plumage and stepped onto the dais to join them.
"To engage in ground combat would cost, would mean expense, but it would be honorable, admirable. A third factor decides, swings the final vote. That is the training need of Talon soldiers, training against wolfling troops. Ground forces shall attack them, beam to beam, hand to Talon."
The issue was decided. A stoop colonel of the Talon soldiers saluted and hurried off with the order. Of course, with this resolution, propriety's perch position would rise a little. Cautions descended, but the quest for dominance had only just begun. So it had been for their distant ancestors, before the Guxiu turned the primitive proto-Gubru into starfarers. Wisely, their patrons had taken the ancient patterns and shaped and expanded them into a useful, logical form of government for a sapient people. Still, part of the older function remained. The suzerain of Beam and Talon shivered as the tension of argument was released, and although all three of them were still quite neuter, the admiral felt a momentary thrill that was deeply, thoroughly sexual. Chapter 21 Pibin and Robert. The two rescue parties encountered each other more than a mile into the high pass. It was a somber gathering. The three who had started out that morning with Benjamin were too tired to do more than nod to the subdued group returning from the crash site. But the battered pair who had been rescued exclaimed on seeing each other.
"Robert! Robert on Eagle! When did they let you out of study hall? Does your mommy know where you are?"
The injured Chim leaned on a makeshift crutch and wore the singed remains of a tattered TAASF ship suit. Robert looked up at him from the stretcher and grinned through an anesthetic haze.
"Fibbin'! In good all's name, was that you I saw smoking out of the sky? Figures. What did you do, fry 10 megacredits worth of scout boat?"
Fibbin rolled his eyes.
"More like 5 megs. She was an old tub, even if she did all right by me."
Robert felt a strange envy.
"So, I guess we got whomped." "You could say that. One-on-one we fought well. Would have been all right if there'd been enough of us."
Robert knew what his friend meant.
"You mean there's no limit to what could have been accomplished with...
with an infinite number of monkeys?"
Fibbin cut in. His snort was a little less than a laugh, but more than an ironic grin. The other Chims blinked in consternation. This level of banter was a bit over their heads, but what was more disturbing was how blithely this Chen interrupted the human son of the planetary coordinator.
"I wish I could have been there with you,"
Robert said seriously. Fibbin shrugged.
"Yeah, Robert, I know. But we all had orders."
For a long moment they were silent. Fibbin knew Megan on Eagle well enough, and he sympathized with Robert.
"Well, I guess we're both due for a stint in the mountains, assigned to holding down beds and harassing nurses."
Fibbin sighed, gazing toward the south.
"If we can stand the fresh air, that is."
He looked down to Robert.
"These Chims told me about the raid on the center. Scary stuff."
"Clenny'll help him straighten things out,"
Robert answered. His attention had started to drift. They obviously had him doped to a dolphin's blowhole.
"She knows a lot. A lot more than she thinks she does."
Fibbin had heard about the daughter of the Timbrimi ambassador.
"Sure,"
he said softly, as the others lifted the stretcher once more.
"An E.T.'ll straighten things out. More likely than not, that girlfriend of yours will have everybody thrown in the clink, invasion or no invasion."
But Robert was now far away, and Fibbin had a sudden strange impression. It was as if the human Mel's visage was not entirely Terran any longer. His dreamy smile was distant and touched with something unearthly.